This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. Thanks so much for listening. Broadcasting back in New York City today. And we're going to begin by looking at the latest unrest in the land of the old Ottoman Empire. We'll discuss a few celebrated trials getting underway this week. Thoughts about Franz Kafka's classic, The Trial. And we'll edge closer to the possibility that someday we might
talk to the animals. Just imagine it, chatting to a chimp in chimpanzee. Imagine talking to a tiger, chatting to a cheetah. Oh, what a neat achievement that would be.
Rex Harrison is Dr. Doolittle there, but later we'll explore, and you'll have to help us decide if this is legit, the idea that animal sounds are organized enough to be an actual language. Speaking in prairie dog instead of flea, that's later this hour. What is that prairie dog saying there? The message here is much clearer, and that's where we begin this hour, the street unrest in Turkey. Is this the sign of a political movement growing in strength against the powerful Prime Minister Erdogan, or is this violence provoked and sustained by the brutality of the Turkish police forces? On the line with us now is Claire Berlinski, freelance reporter in Turkey, also a senior fellow for Turkey at the American Foreign Policy Center. Claire, welcome to the program.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
So in these kinds of situations, and I've had some experience, not in Turkey, but in other parts of the Middle East, as things get out of control, every day begins with a sense that you don't know what to expect. How did you start this day? And has it gotten to that point in this unrest?
Yeah, it has gotten to that point. And let me put it this way. There are a lot of old hand journalists here who have covered a lot of police interventions. And one of them said, this is the worst I've seen since Tiananmen Square. That's probably something of an exaggeration, but it was beyond belief. It's one of the most disgusting things I've ever seen.
In the sense that the police are dealing very brutally with the protesters. In a sense, the police
animals.
Are acting out the
rest. Savages. Animals. What we saw, we couldn't believe. And there were about 30,000 people in the square. Many had come with their children because the governor had promised it is perfectly safe. And they came in with water cannon and plastic bullets and tear gas. The cops have actually chased people into the hospitals and gassed the hospitals, chased people down the streets, spraying tear gas at them indiscriminately and cornering them so that they cannot get out just to create panic. These are people who had nothing to do with this, who weren't even in Taksim Square.
Let's talk a little bit about what might be going on here. I mean, yes, I think it is the case that the Turkish police do have a reputation for not messing around at all, although I've never heard of anything like this. In some sense, are law enforcement authorities acting out the rhetoric of Prime Minister Erdogan, who has said we're going to deal with this very, very concretely?
Well, this is the very strange thing, because I have seen many a time the police here do a fine professional job of crowd control. They know how to do it. I've seen them handle very difficult situations with impeccable professionalism, doing everything that one would wish a police force to do under a situation that could be tense. So this is, I would not say it's aberrant, because there have been mounting reports of this for, oh, probably about 2 years. And I've certainly been gassed more than a few times myself. But when they don't want to be professional, they're not. When they do want to be, they are. They know the difference.
How much political credibility has been eroded now for the Turkish leadership? And, you know, this does appear to be escalating.
Well, trying to be very scientific about it, the places that have been most heavily gassed are not districts that vote for the AKP anyway, the ruling party here.
Right.
You know, this has obviously been thought out. What we really need to know, and we don't have firm polling data on it yet, is how this is going over where the AKP is very strong, which is in places like Konya and Kayseri. And it seems to me they must be getting some feedback that their base doesn't mind this. But the one poll we do have, which is not a nonsense poll, is showing that the AKP is going down and the CHP is picking, the main opposition party CHP is picking up. Now, the problem here is that CHP is really not very strong. They're a very weak opposition party. And the reason that the AKP is still in power is because there's nowhere else for voters to go.
Claire, finally, before we go, let's just review the bidding a little bit. The government, at least according to the BBC, seems to have admitted that police this week have overreacted and have been too brutal in their crackdown. We've got reports of 5,000 or more injuries across the country, and the government says 600 police officers have been injured. Some context?
First, they said, yes, we've been a little excessive, and then they continued to do it first. Second, a parliamentary motion to investigate whether they'd been investigated was just shot down this morning.
All right, so we're in a state of standoff right now, and it's hard to evaluate the seriousness of the government in trying to de-escalate this here.
Well, I would say the seriousness is zero because this could have been de-escalated in 5 minutes flat. I mean, really, this was a bunch of kids camping out in a park, and all you had to do was go and speak to them and maybe, you know, tell them there's free ice cream and jugglers down the street, and it would have been de-escalated, really. It's the most crazy thing I've seen.
And instead, we have a national crisis in Turkey, the likes of which haven't been seen by some observers for decades. Claire Belinsky, thanks so much.
Thank you. Thank you very much for having me. It's been a pleasure.
Claire Belinsky is a freelance reporter in Turkey, also a senior fellow for Turkey at the American Foreign Policy Center. To Washington now. Big surprise, right? The lawyers are all over the latest surveillance scandal in Washington. Yesterday, the ACLU filed a lawsuit against the Obama administration asking a judge to issue an injunction to stop the program and to purge all of the records collected so far. And so far, it's unclear how any of us might sue for damages over all this. Maybe the Fourth Amendment should hire a personal injury attorney. Meanwhile, some of the companies are trying to get out from under the perception they have become agents of the U.S. government. Google filed a written request to Attorney General Eric Holder and FBI Director Robert Mueller asking for permission to reveal details about classified requests it receives. Another big surprise, Edward Snowden, the Booz Allen Hamilton employee, leaker, whistleblower, officially fired yesterday by the defense contractor, calling news of his leak shocking and a grave violation of the code of conduct and core values of our firm, says Booz Allen Hamilton. Snowden had a top secret government security clearance, a tight fraternity, small club, right? Just about 1.4 million individuals have a top secret security clearance, I guess, and their spouses and boyfriends and girlfriends too, right? In all, more than 4.9 million individuals have some kind of security clearance. To help us understand what's going on here, joining us now, John Schindler, professor of national security affairs at the U.S. Naval War College, a former NSA intelligence analyst. John Schindler, welcome.
Hi, glad to be here.
So 1.4 million top secret security clearance holders. Too many, just about right. It feels inflationary to me.
That's because it is inflationary. The numbers have risen considerably over the last decade as the intelligence community and the Defense Department have seen their budgets rise along with it.
Psychologically, and the Pentagon has a track record on this, when you grant somebody a top secret security clearance, the rules are, of course, tell nobody. But is there an expectation that the information will move in a tight circle?
Absolutely. If you're working at the top secret at above level where Mr. Snowden was, the top secret code word or special intelligence, which means usually NSA related, those are handled in special offices with special communications chains. These are not discussed. You know, it's like per Fight Club. You don't talk about Fight Club. You know, it is completely walled off. And certainly, hopefully, one is not having too much pillow talk with your spouse or partner about these things if that person isn't also cleared for it.
Now, for subcontractors to be, I wouldn't say routinely, but it seems fairly commonly granted top secret status, the subcontractor might have different rules about all this.
Well, the security norms at a place like NSA or CIA, where Mr. Snowden worked both those places as a contractor, at least in theory, the security protocols for obtaining it and maintaining security clearances are exactly the same for government employees and contractors. That said, you know, in practice, the contractor standards can be a little bit lower. Certainly, they're harder to keep track of because these individuals, as with Mr. Snowden, move from company to company, contract to contract, often very quickly.
Well, that's what I want to ask you about. Now, I remember J. Robert Oppenheimer, you know, lost his security clearance, and that was sort of his moment of being discredited. But I was surprised in reading that story, rereading that story, that individuals take their security clearances even when they leave their job. So it's possible that Snowden might have gotten a top secret clearance at NSA, but then he's able to maintain it if he moves to McDonald's?
Yes. Depending on your level of security clearance, even after you leave a contract, it remains in effect for a period of months, often a year. So it is possible to go, as you said, work at McDonald's for a while and then go back to NSA. Obviously, if you're gone for more than a year, you will be reinvestigated and the process starts all over again.
Okay, so there is a year trigger.
Usually, yes.
Usually, yes. See, that feels a little mushy to me, John.
No. Certainly, I can tell you that NSA and CIA, if you were, as we would say, out of access for more than a year, you would be reinvestigated, definitely.
All right. Now, the question of what this individual did with this information, the knowledge of security clearances, does he understand absolutely clearly that he's committing some very serious crime right now?
Absolutely. I can state with confidence that any person who has been read into top secret code word access is abundantly clear that one doesn't go out and talk to the media about this, much less take classified materials out of the building with you. That would be very hard to mistake.
Now, the rules in the military are, at least in theory on some level, and you know the details far better than I do, that an immoral order, some sort of order that is completely out of the norms of human conduct, soldiers are permitted to disobey those orders. In terms of top secret clearance, is there any protocol whatsoever for if you see something that's been classified and that's just crazy, it's okay to make it public?
Federal whistleblower statutes do nonetheless apply even to top secret information, but it must be clear that the conduct is illegal. In other words, if one found, and you know, as if one were seeing a bad movie, a Jason Bourne movie, your agency is assassinating American persons, I would be the first in line to be calling the FBI, and I'd feel good about that. Right. However, one does not ever have the right to decide what, well, this feels wrong to me, therefore I'm going to expose it. That's just not acceptable at all. And it's very clear internally that that's not acceptable. And there is a chain of command internally if you believe there is wrongdoing. You know, an inspector general chain of command in the intelligence agencies, just as in the Department
right.
of Defense. If you believe there is illegality, there is a process to have that investigated.
All right. Thinking about Snowden with John Schindler, professor of national security affairs at the U.S. Naval War College. Thanks so much.
Okay. Thank you. Bye.
Edward Snowden is a fugitive. That's clear. What else is he?
My name's Anthony from New Jersey, and I don't think Snowden's a hero. I think he's a patriot.
My name's Gary. I'm from Port Washington, New York. People labeling him a hero are ridiculous. He's undermined something that was passed by all branches of the government, the Congress, the President, and the Supreme Court, and had proper oversight. And he's jeopardized a program that we need for our security. In addition, someone doesn't pick up and run like a coward and then claim they're a hero.
We love you being a part of this conversation later this hour. The Orwellian and the Kafkaesque. What might we add to that? Wikileakian, Assange-esque, Googleific. If you could write a novel about the world today and nail it like Kafka and Orwell nailed the 20th century, what would your title be? Send us your novel titles by calling us at 877-8-MY-TAKE. From the headlines to the silver screen to a courtroom in Boston, the long-awaited trial of accused crime boss James Whitey Bulger is underway in Boston. Many, many people believe this day would never come and that Bulger's mythology and image would remain in popular culture, like Jack Nicholson's portrayal of a Bulger-like character in the movie The Departed.
Those guys you tuned up, they're connected down Providence. What they're gonna do is come back with some guys and kill you. Which, sure as you're born, they will do. Unless I stop them. Do you want me to stop them?
Is this something I can't do personally?
Jack Nicholson and Leo DiCaprio there. Even Big Jack, though, fades in comparison to the real Bulger, one of the nation's most wanted fugitives, up there with Osama bin Laden for years. After 16 years on the run, Bulger was caught in California. He's 83 years old now. He stands accused of having a hand in the murders of 19 people, some while he was working for federal investigators as an informant. Reporters with the Boston Globe back in 1988 first revealed Bulger's role as an FBI informant. Dick Lehr was a reporter for the Boston Globe for almost two decades. He's co-authored two books about Bulger, his latest, a biography called Whitey, The Life of America's Most Notorious Mob Boss. Dick Lehr, welcome to the show.
Hi, how are you?
Take us into this character. I mean, are we going to see much of what you've discovered in following him for so many years?
In many ways, I think his legal defense that he's putting forth is a reflection of Whitey himself. And by that I mean it's been established that Whitey's a psychopath, and he's a supreme narcissist. And in tracing his life story, one of the themes of his life is that I'm not as bad as everyone's made me out to be. I'm a good bad guy. And his defense is, like I say, an echo of that. He's trying to portray himself as not an informant. There's all this pretzel logic out there. I'm not an informant, but also the FBI and the government gave me legal immunity to commit my crimes, in effect a license to kill. In exchange for his underworld intelligence, he's arguing that the FBI and a federal prosecutor promised him immunity, not only for past crimes, but for future crimes. It's, you know, to some lawyers I talk to, laugh out loud. It's unheard of. But Whitey will say and do anything. You know, if you're coming from Whitey Bulger and you've been protected all these years by a corrupt band of agents, I do understand why he has this sense of entitlement. He was protected on the street, but it doesn't mean corruption is lawful.
Is this part of the narcissism, thinking he has some special get-out-of-jail-free card? And how does that narcissism play? I mean, we all know narcissists, very few of whom have, you know, allegedly killed 19 people.
Yeah, no, I mean, again, it goes back to his formative years. Every time he was arrested, he found a way of avoiding any real consequence. So he developed this, you know, larger-than-life sense of himself early on. And the climax of it being from the mid-70s into the early 90s, when indeed he had corrupted a band of FBI agents in Boston, so they, in effect, served as his palace guard, tipping him off, protecting him, insulating him from other law enforcement investigations. You know, who wouldn't feel special under those circumstances when you have the nation's top law enforcement agency, in effect, part of your gang?
Did you, in the course of your investigation and your long sort of connection with this story, ever get the sense that you understood his power over people, his sort of personal charm being ability, you know, giving him an ability to make people do things that they would never do for anyone else?
Yeah, no, I think I have after all these years. And in terms of interviews with people who lived near him and around him, whether it was during his boyhood years or his neighbors in Santa Monica, where he did hide in plain sight under the alias of Charlie Gasco for 14 years. He's a very effective, charming guy in creating what I call a comfort zone around him immediately, where he seems, as Charlie Gasco, for example, friendly old guy next door who would be conversational, offer him a token gift and whatnot. He seemed nice that way. But this is the same guy. I mean, beware of Whitey kindness, of Whitey love, because in an instant, if he sensed betrayal or if he sensed trouble, I mean, he would kill you.
Where does he stand in terms of his own legend? Are there places in Boston where he's revered in some sense, or has he lost all of his old constituency from the days when Boston had a different reputation than it does today?
Yeah, no, that's a good question. I mean, one of the interesting things about him is that he is 83. He's had a long shelf life. And in studying Whitey's life, you realize there are many phases, many masks of Whitey Bulger. And until the truth came out that he was actually an informant for many years, he had this reputation, in which is now myth, that he was kind of a Robin Hood figure in Boston in the 70s and 80s. Again, kind of the good bad guy, this charming gangster. Well, that's been blown out of the water. And anyone who holds on to that image of Whitey Bulger, that mask of Whitey, is living in denial.
As an 83-year-old, it's kind of hard to evaluate what a life sentence would mean for Bulger at this point. Do you think he looks across that courtroom or will be looking across that courtroom and basically saying, I defeated you all. Do what you want with me. But
I think there, we write at the end of our book when he was first brought back to Boston in June of 2011, and he walked into, you know, the courthouse for the first time and his younger brother Bill was there, and they traded a look that I, for the life of me, believe that's what they were, look how far we've gotten, and we did it our way. Now, I think he's fully engaged in this trial. I mean, this is, you know, this is the last hurrah for him, no question. He's toast. But it doesn't mean he's not fully engaged in the strategy and the power play and trying to push back and assert his own control over the situation. That's what has motivated him. That's what makes his heart beat, I think, throughout his life, is power, control, staying one step ahead in the game that he's chosen to play, even though the circumstances might change, from being crime boss, being pursued by police, being a fugitive from justice, being pursued, you know, when he's Charlie Gasco, and now in the courtroom, being a defendant, being pursued by prosecutors trying to bring him to justice.
Dick Lehr is a journalism professor at Boston University, former reporter for the Boston Globe, and the co-author of two books on James Whitey Bulger, including Whitey, The Life of America's Most Notorious Mob Boss, and Black Mass, The True Story of an Unholy Alliance Between the FBI and the Irish Mob. Dick, thanks so much.
You're welcome. Thank you.
You're listening to The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI Public Radio International in collaboration with The New York Times and WGBH Boston Public Radio.
They're not really used to big show trials up in Boston with media scrutiny, every bit of testimony chewed over by the likes of shrieking TV prosecutor pundit Nancy Grace.
Look, I've heard a lot about crazy sex, but when you introduce a gun into this scenario, that's a little too crazy.
But our next guest, author and Miami Herald columnist Carl Hyacin, says Boston could learn a thing or two from Florida. Show trials go on in the Sunshine State all the time. The latest is the trial of George Zimmerman for the second-degree murder of Trayvon Martin. Hyacin says the Zimmerman trial is unusual, for while everyone in the state is following the proceedings, there's probably no one in Seminole County who actually wants to serve on that jury.
Being a spectator at these trials is the new hot ticket in town. Casey Anthony went on forever, and people lined up every day, you know, to get a seat in that trial. Because you feel like you have a chance at being on TV or seeing something close to history being made. I mean, it's the sort of the lurid nature of the cameras in the courtroom, which Florida has had for many, many years, and there's a good side and a bad side to it. But in this case, you know, the trial itself, the minute they came in and said they were going to charge the guy with second-degree murder, and I mean, I think I said it in a column, too, that's a very, very tough case to make for second-degree murder. I mean, it's an obvious manslaughter case from a prosecutor's point of view, but second-degree murder is very tough. In a Central Florida jury, very, very tough. You know, they tend to be a conservative jury anyway. And, you know, I just think it's going to be a long, long, messy trial, and people will want to be there to say they've been there. And it becomes, you know, there is a theme park element to the whole thing after a while if you get enough publicity.
But wanting to be responsible for that verdict, that's something, unlike in the Anthony trial, that's something that people don't want any part of down there, it seems like.
No, and because you don't want to be, you know, I mean, it's such a polarizing case, and you don't want to come down on either side of it. And you know, people are afraid of getting hate mail. They're afraid of being identified, publicly identified as jurors, although the judge can stop that if they want to. But to put it bluntly, it's more fun to be a spectator than it is to have the responsibility of somebody's life in your hands, especially in a case that's as racially charged as this one.
And as the summer gets going, there are more places to be spectators in Florida probably than any place else in the United States.
Yeah, I mean, it's become the national appetite for having a trial to watch. And I forget who the last, what was it, Jody Arias or, you know, and you basically take in that case just your, honestly, your basic domestic boyfriend-girlfriend deal, a homicide that every cop has worked in his lifetime. And when you drag that into a reality TV, you know, live coverage for months and months and months, and it basically boils down to a two-bit domestic homicide. And it's tragic for the victim and everything else, but to see it showcased and bannered every night on TV, when in the old days these trials are going on all over the place, but nobody was watching. You know, you didn't have TV to bring it into people's living room.
And so now that it's in all our living rooms and court is in session, we all get to be the jury. You out there get to be the jury. We'll have more with Carl Hyacin in a moment, but what do you think of that idea? Are we always on the larger jury in these trials, especially if they are about race in America? That was certainly the case in the O.J. and Rodney King trials. Would you want to be on that jury in Sanford, Florida? Call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE or go to thetakeaway.org. More with Carl Hyacin in a moment, talking about his hilarious new book, Bad Monkey, next. Carl Hyacin loves Florida, but you wouldn't know it from reading his many books. They take down his state of theme parks, strip malls, corrupt entrepreneurs, and the like. His most recent book is called Bad Monkey, where you've got Medicare fraud, real estate swindlers, people degrading the environment. And in this case, Carl goes right for the jugular, the many touristy restaurants and the inspectors who declare all those crab cakes and shrimp cocktails safe.
In the case of Yancey, the character in the book, you know, it doesn't take long before someone offers him a bribe or a free meal or something to overlook a random roach leg or something like that. And he reacts indignantly because, you know, he's from sort of the old cop school. I mean, he thinks that his integrity is being questioned. But at the same time, he understands it's a tough – I don't know. I mean, I didn't hang out with these guys because I'd never eat again if I did. So I just I really stuck – my research was really just looking at the reports online and seeing the kind of detail they had to go into. But it's still – I mean, every one of us who eats out in a restaurant is grateful for the hard work and diligence. I say that on the record.
It is pretty dramatic, though. I mean, you've been around the city where you see these grades that are on all the restaurants in Mayor Bloomberg's New York, A, B, and C, and pending. There's some signs that say pending. I was in a sushi place about a month ago, and it didn't have a rating yet. And in the middle of our dinner, this guy came in, and it was clear to the very smiling Japanese sushi chef there at the restaurant that this was the inspector and that there was suddenly a huge degree of tension, and the place was packed. And when the guy left, everyone in the restaurant stood up and cheered as though there'd been some Olympics that took place right there in the middle of the restaurant. This is pretty dramatic stuff.
I'm not sure it's as rigorous everywhere else in the country, John. I'm pretty sure in the Florida Keys it's a little less formal. I think that Mayor Bloomberg, you know, takes a fairly rigid approach to that stuff. But in the practicality of living in a place where of urban sprawl like Florida, where, you know, there's five restaurants at every interstate stop, I mean, I think it's a little more random. I think you go in, and if the sushi chef is wearing a hazmat suit, you go out. I think that's pretty – say, maybe another choice today.
That's your rule of thumb.
Yes.
Yeah, hazmat suit, don't go there.
Right, right. Black crepe around the front door is another thing. Not good.
You know, the title of this book is Bad Monkey, and that title and the reason why the book is called Bad Monkey is, once again, a product of your very extraordinary imagination. Can you just give me a sense of the why here in this? what piece of your upbringing, your life, produced this character?
Well, listen, I very briefly owned a monkey. When I was 11 years old, my little sister and I, this was back a long, long time ago, and they had these ads in the back of these magazines that said, pet monkey. And we thought, that would be great. We loved animals. We'd get a pet monkey. And we wouldn't tell mom. We would just send our money off. It was like $16.95. And like 4 weeks later, a monkey shows up in a crate. And my mother, of course, had no idea. My dad, we never told about it. And in those days there was no controls. You could send any kind of wild animal anywhere you wanted, and the monkey wasn't happy. We weren't happy. You can imagine that, you know, 4 days in a UPS truck, what his frame of mind was by the time he got to our house. But it was not a good experience. But I empathize with that critter. And in the book, Bad Monkey, I've been every movie I go to and every sitcom you watch, there's like a gratuitous monkey. They're just monkeys for comic effect. There's no backstory to the monkey, and they don't have any real role in the plot. And I wanted a monkey with substance and a monkey who had something important to do. And in this case, my monkey in the book has been fired from the set of one of the Johnny Depp pirate movies for an unspeakable act. And he is sort of the Charlie Sheen of monkeys. But as you get to know him and you understand where he's coming from and what a tough life in show business it is for a monkey, it's not an easy life even for a human, but for a monkey it's really tough. Then you understand, you know, why he's there and the importance of his role in the plot.
And unlike all those sellouts in Hollywood, what you've created here, first in literature, is a message monkey.
It is a message monkey. And I was telling someone last night, if just imagine Gatsby. If Fitzgerald had thought to put a monkey in The Great Gatsby, what a different story that would be.
Carl Hiaasen, thanks so much.
Hey, thanks, John.
What we're going to talk about now is an old idea given to us, perhaps first, by the good doctor, Dr. Doolittle.
Polynesia, I want you to teach me everything you know.
What? 2,000 languages?
Certainly. We'll start at 8 o'clock tomorrow morning.
But it took me over 100 years.
Then we'll start at 7 o'clock. There's not a moment to lose. Matthew, think what it would mean if I could talk to the animals.
That's right. What would it be like if we could talk to the animals and they could talk to us, conversing in hippopotamus, pelican, Pekingese, or hippo? The fantasy is one thing. Movies are full of talking animals. The reality involves the studying of the subtle organization of animal sounds, from bird songs to frog clicks, baying to neighing. Do these songs actually work like language? Now, Professor Slobodchikov, this actually means something to you, right?
Yes, it does. This is a prairie dog giving an alarm call, and in the alarm call, the predator is being described, and not only is the prairie dog giving the species of predator, such as coyote or human or dog, but also the prairie dog is describing the size and shape of the predator and the coat color of the predator, or if it's a human, the color of clothes that the human is wearing, something about the size and shape of the human.
That's a lot of meaning into one set of squeaks there. We're talking with Khan Slobodchikov. He's a professor emeritus at Northern Arizona University, president and CEO of Animal Communications Limited. How did you get all that from what sounds like a continuous squeak?
That's the end result of about 30 years of careful experiments where we recorded the alarm calls of prairie dogs. We recorded the escape behaviors of the prairie dogs when a predator appeared. We also played back the alarm calls of the prairie dogs when no predator was there. We recorded the escape responses of the prairie dogs and compared them to when the predator was actually present. We set up experiments where we had humans wearing different colored clothes. We had experiments where we had different dogs of different shapes and different sizes. And so all of that comes from a 30-year study of decoding the language of prairie dogs, which at the moment is the most sophisticated animal language that we know about.
All right. Now, we're talking with Khan Slobodchikov, professor emeritus at Northern Arizona University, describing this 30-year career of study, and with the stipulation that, you know, your first name is Khan. I'm a skeptic. Let me just say that straight up ahead. And you've been everywhere talking about this. I've seen that. I'm just wondering is if in terms of language, there's a fundamental difference between describing a cry of a dog or a prairie dog, which, they're obviously mad, versus that means something really specific. One is a mood. The other is a language.
Sure. Well, in my book, Chasing Dr. Doolittle, Learning the Language of Animals, I go into that fairly extensively, and I point out the differences between communication, which essentially is addressing the mood aspect that you're talking about, and language itself, which is communicating a lot of different information where the animal actually has a toolbox of signals that the animal can choose. So the animal has flexibility in the choice of the signals. The animal intends to communicate. The animal can choose novel signals to use, and the signals have a structure, a grammatical structure, just the way that our language has a grammatical structure.
All right, Professor, I'm going to play another example here, and I understand you're electronically connected, so you might not be able to get all of the nuance in the connection that we have right now. But just in general, let's listen to another prairie dog selection here and try to deconstruct the sound a little bit here. All right, now what part's the mood there? What part is the nouns and verbs?
Well, you have to understand that all of this information, the nouns and the verbs and the adjectives, are all rolled up in a single chirp, which lasts a tenth of a second. So what you heard was chirp, 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 chirp. This is the prairie dog repeating the same information. So, for example, the chirps might say, human, And they might also say wearing blue shirt. They might also say tall and thin. They might also say walking slowly. All of that is rolled up into a tenth of a second. And what is really important there is the frequency and time changes within that chirp. Prairie dog language is a tonal language, very much like Navajo or like Chinese. And so the changes in the tones with time within that tenth of a second convey exactly specific points of information, and like whether it's a blue shirt.
Right. And part of this is enabled by technology that allows you to really deconstruct waveforms and things. Now, before we go, let me just ask, is it possible that your contention that prairie dogs have the most sophisticated animal language has something to do with the fact that you're professor emeritus at Northern Arizona University, where there are a lot of prairie dogs?
Well, yes, in part that is true, because since I happen to be at Northern Arizona University, where there used to be a lot of prairie dogs were a natural subject for me to study, but it was a happy accident in the sense that prairie dogs are social colonial animals that live in colonies called towns, and the towns don't move from day to day, unlike, say, monkeys or unlike whales or dolphins, which move around. And so it's hard to go back to exactly the same spot and record the same individuals, which I can do with the prairie dogs.
Well, it's great now, stuff. Professor, we're going to have to leave it there, but let's get back in touch. We'll talk a little more about language, especially when college gets out and people have to be concerned about tests. There's an academic exercise.
People can read about it in my book, Chasing Dr. Doodle.
Excellent. Khan Slobotchikov is professor emeritus at Northern Arizona University, professor and CEO of Animal Communications Limited. So we're talking to you about if you could write a novel about America, the world today, kind of a 1984, and trying to nailing our circumstances. We're getting novel titles from you. A listener in Bellevue, Washington, would title his novel Much Ado About Redacted, or The Top Secret Garden. Lyndon from Stillwater, Oklahoma writes, nobody expects the NSA Inquisition. I like that one. This is a listener in Orlando, Florida. Everything went numb, apathy, security, safety, and oversight in the NSA. So which is it, Orwellian or Kafkaesque? We'll talk about that in just a moment on this public radio program. Stay with us. And now, at the risk of opening oneself up to charges of extreme self-parody, this public radio program will engage in a live broadcast discussion of whether the latest surveillance scandals uncovered in Washington are Orwellian or Kafkaesque. Orwellian as in this.
Stand up straighter. Look me in the face. Tell me, Winston, and remember, no lies. What are your true feelings towards Big Brother?
I hate him.
You must love him. It's not enough to obey him. You must love him.
Actors John Hurt and Richard Burton in the movie 1984, based on George Orwell's book that changed the English language. And then there's Kafkaesque.
Before the law, there stands a guard. A man comes from the country, seeking admittance to the law, but the guard cannot admit him. Can the man hope to enter at a later time?
I've heard it before. We've all heard it. The man is dying of old age, still waiting there. And just at the end, the guard tells him that the door was meant for him, only for him.
The guard tells him no one could enter this door. And now I'm going to close it.
Orson Welles there and Tony Perkins in the, I should say, dreadful movie of Kafka's classic, The Trial. So one can think of government surveillance as Big Brother in Orwell's 1984. We can think of the government intelligence operation also as a mindless, incomprehensible guardian who only slams doors in people's faces, as in Kafka's The Trial. But do we really need some new words here? Have we lost some precision in all of this use of the words Kafkaesque and Orwellian? Robert Coles knows a bit about George Orwell. He's a professor of cultural history at De Montfort University in Leicester, England. Professor, welcome.
Hi.
Also with us, Rebecca Rosen, senior associate editor at The Atlantic. She's fond of Kafkaesque to describe what's going on today. Welcome, Rebecca.
Hi, thanks for having me.
So, Robert, let's start with you. What would Orwell think of the throwing about of the term Orwellian? He'd probably be complimented first, I suppose.
Yeah, well, words like Orwellian came pretty much after Orwell died. Orwell was just an ordinary guy writing brilliant stuff as he came upon it. He was really a journalist more than an aspiring artist. But I think he would have been a bit embarrassed by using the term. That's not to say, of course, we can't use it, because I think it's very apt. I'm not here to argue it isn't Kafkaesque, but it's certainly Orwellian, what's going on at the moment.
I'm going to play you another clip from that 1984 movie called 1984. And in some ways, if you look deeper into Orwell, you find much sharper similarities with what's going on today. Here's a reference to the Cold War in 1984 that, of course, hadn't begun by the time Orwell wrote 1984, that seems to be an exact parallel to the War on Terror. Listen.
The war is not meant to be won. It is meant to be continuous. The essential act of modern warfare is the destruction of the produce of human labor. A hierarchical society is only possible on the basis of poverty and ignorance. In principle, the war effort is always planned to keep society on the brink of starvation. The war is waged by the ruling group against its own subjects, and its object is not victory over Eurasia or East Asia, but to keep the very structure of society intact.
Orwell's idea of endless war, relevant in our time, Robert Coles?
Yeah, I think it's more relevant during the period of the Cold War, where Orwell prophesied or foresaw that it was a good way of keeping both sides' populations tame by arguing that both sides were endlessly at war. Now, of course, the War on Terror is too abstract to put together. We don't know its beginning, we don't know when it ends, and we don't really know what it is in the middle. He would have approved of that, but he would not have approved of any suggestion that the Cold War was not a real war. Hmm. He was very clear whose side he was on there. He was clearly on the side of the British and the Americans against the Soviet Union, which he saw as a monstrous tyranny.
Interesting. So the War on Terror is a little beyond the abstraction even of Orwell. Rebecca Rosen, Kafka loved abstraction. He loved the War on Terror.
Right. I mean, I think that at least at a very fundamental level, the way the War on Terror has been used or is being used to justify these programs, I mean, it's relevant both to Orwell's 1984 and, I mean, Kafka wasn't looking at a war, but the notion that the government was doing things beyond your control and for reasons you didn't understand, I think at that very abstracted level, there is a parallel.
When you think of Kafka, you think a little bit of Edward Snowden in this subcontractor world, kind of a two-bit top secret security clearance fellow who sees all this stuff going on. Whether you support him or not, he was caught in a fairly Kafkaesque Booz Allen Hamilton.
Sure. I think that there's some interesting parallels between Snowden and Joseph K., the main character in the trial. But I think, I mean, beyond the eerie fact of their being very similar in age, but I think that the analogy that I have been picking up on and have written about isn't so much about Snowden, but is about the NSA's programs more specifically.
So Kafka described a very cruel world in his books, I think. Mm-hmm. Is this cruelty here or just a sort of dumb mechanized government operations?
Yeah, it seems more like the latter for now. I think the concern is really the secrecy of it and the potential abuses of it in the future. I haven't seen evidence of the abuses yet, but I think we don't know because everything has been very secretive. So I think in the paper that I was looking at by Daniel Solov, the legal scholar at George Washington University, I think that the concerns he has about these programs are more about how we don't know what's going on and how they could be abused down the road.
Robert Coles, if Orwell were alive today, What do you think he would hone in on in 2013 as going on in our lives right now to really extract and you know, change the language once again?
Yeah, well, I think the big point, John, is to say that 1984 is about 1949 in London. And in that sense, it's got very little to do with what happens now. I mean, nobody makes a phone call in 1984. It's all about bits of paper being burnt in a furnace. But if Orwell came back now, he would just forget all that stuff and see the big point. And the big point is that all centralized states and power systems have a will to power. They want power for power's sake, and no detail is too small for them to amass in order to get what they think they're going to get through having those details, which is power. Mm. That's what he would home in on, and that's why he would approve of this Orwellian-type analogy that's being made in the U.S. at the moment.
All right. Robert Coles is a professor of cultural history at De Montfort University. Rebecca Rosen, Kafka would just notice that he's realism, not fantasy anymore.
I suppose. I mean, I think Kafka maybe always felt that way.
Rebecca Rosen is a senior associate editor at The Atlantic. If you could write a novel about the world today, nail it like Kafka and Orwell nailed the 20th century, give us your title, Betrayal, the not-so-new SS of the American Taliban from Salt Lake City, Utah. From Dallas, The Price of Freedom, The Arbiters of Liberty, Kings Among Men, The Cost of Comfort. And from Orleans, Massachusetts, Below the Surface, Bloodletting Americans. We always want to hear from you every day. The Takeaway involves listeners in the next day's program. You can always reach us by calling 8778-MY-TAKE. Thanks so much for listening, along with the NSA. I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
The Takeaway is supported by the Henry Luce Foundation for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia. And the Rockefeller Foundation, whose transportation initiative is promoting equitable and sustainable developments in communities across the country.
There's a lot going on right now. Mounting economic inequality, threats to democracy, environmental disaster, the sour stench of chaos in the air. I'm Brooke Gladstone, host of WNYC's On the Media. Want to understand the reasons and the meanings of the narratives that led us here, and maybe how to head them off at the pass? That's On the Media's specialty. Take a listen wherever you get your podcasts.